everybody. You're probably laughing at all this stuff up here. What in the heck? But, you know, it gives you something to look at besides me. That's always good. Today we are in 1 Corinthians 1 through 10. And I have been over and over and over these chapters because for all my life I've wanted to understand Paul. And now we're really getting into his head. You know, it would be easy to think that this letter written from Paul, 1 Corinthians, to the little branch in Corinth on the Greek island of Achaia was a mishmash of ideas and suggestions and comments, but really it's quite organized and logical. However, it is a letter, and so the ideas flow organically, like in any letter. But I find a consistent theme running through these chapters, and that is, how do you know the things of the Spirit? How do you know truth, with a capital T? How do you know the things of God and how to be one with God? So I read an article that my son-in-law gave me from Sports Illustrated, of all places, by a man named Steve Ruschen. And he talks about the importance, really the joy of the written word. For example, here is a sports quote that he repeats. The incomparable Vince Scully said recently of a bloop single by the Dodgers' Andre Ethier, "It sounded like he hit it with the morning paper." You're not laughing. That was so hilarious to me. He sounded like he hit it with the morning paper. So he's making a joke, right? So my point is, in telling you about this article, is that the end he says, "This is one of reading's great tricks, the way it can transport you through time or remove you from it completely." And that is where we are going, through time to AD 50 and getting into the Apostle Paul's head. So, if you look at Acts 18, Diane talked about last week, Acts 18 is kind of the historical basis of what happened in Corinth. So verse 1 of Acts 18, Paul leaves Athens and goes to Corinth, about 50 miles away. So it's like he traveled from here to Provo, right? And there he founded a church. He stays on this island of Achaia, living with Aquila and Priscilla, whom he met there, and worked within a shop making tents. So if you look at Acts 18, 1 through 3, it talks about them. Verse 3, "For by occupation they were tent makers, and he was also a tent maker." In those days, Jewish men always had to have a trade, and Paul made tents or leather working. So he stays on this island with them until his troubles force him out about 18 months later. It says in verse 13 of Acts 18 that they were angry at him. The Jews were angry at him. "This fellow persuadeth men to worship God contrary to the law." So they make him leave, and he travels to Ephesus with Priscilla and Aquila, and stays there a short time, and then goes on to Jerusalem, and then he comes back, and eventually stays there almost 3 years, if you look at verse 19 in Ephesus. So he's there, and when he's there, he gets some bad news from this little branch in Corinth. He'd written them a letter, which is now lost. If you look at, we're over now in 1 Corinthians. If you look at verse 5, Paul writes, it's reported commonly that there is. So he uses this over and over again because he's answering this letter that he wrote them, and then he got one back from them, and both of those letters are lost. So we only know what was in them from what he is writing, and he's answering their questions. He's talking about what's happened and what he's heard. So this news he gets is bad news, and he's pretty unhappy about it. He's also visited by these people from Chloe's house, if you look at 1 and 11 now of 1 Corinthians. And they are explaining to him what's going on back in Corinth. So is that all clear as mud? Probably not. Okay. So a little bit about Corinth, because when I read this, I have to have a context. It explains it. It makes it richer. So Corinth was across from Athens, across the sea, and on this island of Achaia. And it was destroyed in about 146 BC by the Romans. Corinth had allied with Sparta, and Rome came in and just crushed them. And they hauled away all the people, either killed them or hauled away them into slavery. You know, you read history, and it's just so sad sometimes. So about 46 BC, Julius Caesar comes in and reestablishes a city in Corinth, and it's a Roman city now. And it was known for being cosmopolitan and worldly and promiscuous. It was wealthy from trade. It was on two ports, but also for holding the Isthmian Games, which were the second most important Greek games in the world. And what would the first one be? The Olympics, right? So people came there all the time, and it was just ethnically diverse. It was, if you look online, you can see pictures of Corinth, and it has these archaeological remains of this temple of Apollo that is just beautiful. It has these columns, and there were many more, but now it's right there in the middle of the city. And then up on this little mountainside called Agra Corinth. Has anyone been there? I'm just looking at pictures, okay. Was the temple of Aphrodite or Venus. And that was where supposedly that there were 1,000 priestesses or prostitutes. So this was quite the place. All through the city there was temples and idols and all kinds of pagan, you know, things. So that's Corinth. But really, it was no more nor less corrupt than most port places at the time. So this letter that we have, this epistle of 1 Corinthians, is Paul's response back from this letter he got from them. And he starts out by addressing what he's heard is happening, and then he answers their questions. So there is a reason for everything that he writes. You can imagine Paul in his house in Ephesus. And he's heard these rumors, and these people have told him things, and he's hearing about that the church has split into factions, that there is divisiveness and immorality and quarrels and arrogance and greed and drunkenness, and his heart must have broken. He'd been gone for 3 years, and a lot can happen in 3 years, and now he's hearing it. So he could have written a letter back that was furious. Or he could have run away like Elijah did. Do you remember the story of Elijah and what was her name? Jezebel? Anyway, he's running from her and her priests, and he's hiding. Anyway, that's another story. He says, take away my life, for I'm no better than my father's. You know, that's Elijah. But instead, Paul writes this letter that is very measured, very stern, but very loving, which is very Paul. Judgment and love are his, you know, characteristics. So he calls verse 1 of chapter 1, he calls Sosthenes to him, which is will be his scribe, to write, and with all of his impressive strength, dictates to him one of the most astonishing and eloquent letters that we have from him. So it's also important that we understand that this letter is written not to Jews, but to Gentiles. So it's all about his relationship with the Hellenistic world that was there at the time. So, and their background is obvious because of all these, you know, things happening. And as always, Christ is the center of his message. And the beginning and the end, though, are God the Father. But in no other epistle is Christ mentioned so many times. In the first 9 verses, his name appears 9 times. No letter has better external proof of authenticity. 40 years later, we have this letter that came from Rome called First Clement, and in it, there are 6 quotes from this letter. So it, you know, kind of is proof that it's real, that it was real. Okay, verse 10 of chapter 1, Paul really hits it. He has greeted them, he has done his usual grace and peace, and then he drops peace, if you want to know, if you notice. Like, look at verse, let's see, 4. He says, you know, I thank my God always on your behalf for the grace of God which is given you, but he does not say anything about peace, and that's because they're at war with each other. So verse 10, he says, I've heard, and I beseech you that there be no divisions among you. And what's happened is they have broken into, look at verse 12, 3 factions. There's Paul's, the people that probably he converted. There's Apollo, who was this man who came from Alexandria, Egypt, this really impressive man, and Cephas, who is Peter. So these people all have their loyalists. And Paul says, verse 13, he kind of hits them with these rhetorical questions. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? He's saying we should be unified under Christ. So it's kind of interesting because the Apollo loyalists were probably the Greeks, because Apollo was this eloquent, educated, probably very charismatic man. So they are kind of in his camp. And then you have Peter's camp, who would be the Jewish converts. And they disclaimed the authority of Paul. They said, hey, he's just a presumptuous interloper. He persecuted the church. He's an apostate Jew. He's just a preaching tent maker. You can hear it all in this background. Well, Peter probably would not have, you know, agreed with any of this, because he's back in Jerusalem, right? But this was happening. So that is why Paul in chapter 1, verse 1, says, I am called to be an apostle. And also in 9:1, he's laying his groundwork. Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus Christ? So he's telling them he has authority. He is an apostle. So that's where that comes from. And like I said, a lot can happen in 3 years. These people were probably of low position and slaves. They weren't the educated elite. And their old habits were coming back. On our mission, we had Puerto Rico and also the Virgin Islands. So we would fly over to these islands in little seaplanes, like once a month, St. Thomas, St. Croix, Tortola was a British Virgin. It was really hard work. Just kidding. It was so much fun. But all of it was fun, not just the seaplanes and flying over. So in St. Thomas, the branch president was Joseph. He was an elderly man and a lovely man. And one day when we flew over and attended the branch, we noticed that they were heating up the sacrament bread in the oven in the kitchen, just this little old building. And we're like, you know. And then when the meeting starts and Joseph is conducting, he says, okay, now we're going to pray. And so we all stood up and held, and he had us hold hands when we prayed. And we realized that when my husband had come over the time before and had sat down with Joseph, and my husband's a very loving man, and he had held his hands and said, Joseph, let's pray, in this little office, which was about this big. And so they had sat, you know, and across from each other and held hands. So Joseph thought that when you prayed, you held hands. And I don't know where the heating up of the bread came from. But so, you know, things happen, as you know, because you've been out there in the mission field, but it's easy to see how things were slipping. And probably their lives were not easier than they had been before they met Paul. I mean, in the old days, before he came along, there was no guilt, no conscience, no sorrow for sin. But now, like Lot's wife, they were looking back on the city of the plain instead of looking up at the mountain where they were supposed to go. So they were saying, were they to have none of their old lives back? Couldn't they go to any idol feasts and get free food? You know, all of these things. And they were slipping. So Paul refuses to engage in who's right and who's wrong. He just denounces the slippage and the factions. It's hard to choose the kingdom of God, isn't it? And to remember that you have been delivered out of Egypt when you're in the wilderness now. And it's hard, and to give up passions that were actually okay, like in Corinth, under the guise of religion, right? They couldn't even complain about it. The pull of the world is mighty, isn't it? So mighty. So Paul begins in verse 17 with this sweep of words about how you know something. He's saying what he really wants to say, that it's God against the world, how they can know God, how they can be known of him, and how to become godlike. So if you look at 2 and 4, he says, "My speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power." He had made a decision not to speak with flowery words. I don't know, with charisma. He probably just hit him all the time. For in verse 18 of chapter 1, he says, "The preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us it's the power of God." So he's making this point, and he's probably also trying to even out Apollo's hero worship of Apollo and their love for his eloquence. Apollo's loved Paul and was his follower, so it's not that. But, you know, we all love a good speaker, right? We do. And that's how Apollos was. In fact, in the raging debate over who wrote Hebrews, and it really is, you start reading stuff and people just are at each other's throats about who really wrote Hebrews. A lot of people think Apollos was either the author of it or a co-author. And from what I've read about Apollos, it wouldn't bother me if he was. I think he was quite an impressive human being. So anyway, in 23 of chapter 1, Paul says, "We preach Christ crucified unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness." What does that mean, unto the Jews a stumbling block? Well, why could they not accept Jesus Christ? Yeah. He didn't. Exactly. He didn't come as they expected, in glory and power and this mighty Messiah who would take them away from the yoke of Rome. And also was how he died. In Deuteronomy, it says 21 and 23 that anybody whose body is hung on a cross is accursed. And it's a sign of rejection from God. So here they have this belief always all over the place, and it was a stumbling block for them to accept Jesus Christ as their long-awaited Messiah. And of course, the Greeks, when they heard it, to them, it's just like ridiculous, right? Because they're so wise. So Paul doesn't back down, though, from that image of Christ on the cross. He talks about it over and over again. He doesn't care. He just hits it over and over again. And it, so verse 27, chapter 1, this is a really famous verse you've heard. "But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. You know, it's amazing when you watch missionaries at work, these young kids. I saw them walking in. I mean, they are amazing. And when we went to pick up our son Jonathan, who left just Johnny, you know, and here we are in Argentina in this little home, just out in the middle of this this chalky, the dirt was like white chalk, and Johnny would ride out and he'd come home and just look like a ghost because it would just get all over him. Anyway, so we went to visit these people and we walked in, and I'm not being sacrilegious, but on their wall was a picture of Jesus and a picture of Johnny. So, I mean, how do they do that? Make them love like that? Your own son, who's just like, you know, Johnny. So I think about this concept of the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God that he's talking about quite a bit when I bump into extreme intellectualism. Because Paul thought little of human wisdom. It had not brought anybody back to God. So here's a question. What is the wisdom of the world? Because it's not learning, is it? We are taught to learn, right? To be educated. So what is it? So I was lying in bed the other day, as you know, thoughts passed through my head. What is it? So, if you haven't read Moses 5 lately, that is a scary chapter to read. You should read it just for your own enlightenment. In Moses 5, Satan teaches Lamech how to become Master Mayhem. And when he teaches him that, Lamech is learning the great secret that one could murder and get gain. Well, this great secret really is, what's it about? It's about scarcity, right? So I'm trying to bring this into our lives, because we probably don't go out and murder and to get money, right? But if you realize that the underlying principle is about scarcity, that there isn't enough power for everybody, there isn't enough love, there isn't enough importance to go around. So in order to get what you need, you murder, you know, to get it. So isn't that what we do a little bit all day, every day? We murder a little bit. We stab somebody so we are bigger, right? We put them down so we become bigger. That is the wisdom of the world. So anything that that puts darkness over light, or lying over truth, or hurting someone over loving them, that is the wisdom of the world, and it's a lie, isn't it? So, that is what Paul is trying to tell them. And, you know, we only have one portion of this, of one side, so one portion of one side of this correspondence. Not much, really. But you can see that these people are having to learn their new identity as people, as God's people. And it's hard, isn't it? It's like when it's like a new member of our church has to make their way and learn how to be one of in the gospel. So but Paul knew that their faith could only be based on not on the wisdom of men and persuasion of men, but only on the wisdom of the Spirit and of God, because only the glory of the Spirit will hold. And so in 1:31 he writes, "He that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord." Don't glory in man's wisdom, only glory in the Lord. So have you ever tried to share something eternal, some insight with another person who looks at you blankly or dismisses it, and you feel like you're standing there holding ashes in your hand? It's quite uncomfortable and humiliating even. Well, Paul moves now so gracefully into explaining that you can only know the wisdom of God through the spiritual man, not the natural man. So now he moves into how you know things. So look at 2, verse 10. "But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God." And verse 14, "But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned." Look at that word "can." Neither can he know them. It's like, you know, trying to explain to a blind man what blue looks like, or having a blind man, you know, paint. He can't know them. He can't, he's saying. It's pretty strong wording. The spiritual man cannot know, the natural man can't know things of God unless he knows them with his spiritual side of him. So a little bit about the natural man. We enter into this life with this clean slate, right? DNC 93:38, you know, talks about that we are innocent in the beginning, but with the same intelligence, we come in with the same intelligence that we had attained to before. You know, I know you have wondered over and over again, why do you have two children that you've raised the same be so totally different, right? So we come in with the intelligence that we had and with certain tendencies. In 1:30:18, in fact, why don't we go there? Doctrine and Covenants. 1:30:18. It says, this beautiful verse, "Whatever principle of intelligence we attain unto in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection." Well, if you infer that back to how we entered this world, it works also. So our choices shaped us there, right, in the pre-existence, and they are shaping us here. They affect how we respond to truth. Do we abandon what we are doing in the favor of truth, or do we try and reshape reality to suit us how we want it? Catherine Thomas said, "Our choices in every sphere tend either to reveal or to conceal things as they really are." And we do it all the time, don't we? If we don't like something, we look at it differently, maybe. In fact, that is what Paul said in his great chapter 13, that with our natural minds, we see the world reflected as in a distorted mirror. For now we see through a glass darkly, he says. So I have brought my old mirror here. This is how they used to have mirrors, right? I mean, it's just my tray, but you get the idea. Because you cannot really see things clearly. It's distorted. So Paul is saying, now we see through a glass darkly. We don't really see it, and that's what we do. And there's this really great quote by Francis Bacon. He used the exact same analogy. All perceptions, as well of the sense as of the mind, are according to the measure of the individual, and not according to the measure of the universe, or which is his word for God. And the human understanding is like a false mirror, which receiving rays irregularly distorts and discolors the nature of things by mingling its own nature with it, what you want to see. So we mingle and mix up and distort reality like a dark mirror because we are seeing things with our natural or carnal or earthly minds, those minds that prefer the wisdom of the world. What does carnal mean? It actually has a definition. It means, in Latin, of the flesh or of the body. It's not some like evil, you know, word. It's just describing the flesh of the body. And that natural or carnal mind that we all have covers over our spiritual mind, doesn't it? And even disables it. So listen to Brigham Young. How difficult it is to teach the natural man who comprehends nothing more than that which he sees with the natural eye. Talk to him about angels or heavens or God or immortality, and it's like sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal to his ears. It has no music to him. So Kathy, I want you to come up and hit my gong. I brought these all the way. We have to hear them. So this I have in my backyard, and my grandkids just love hitting it, waking up the neighbors. But you have to be a little firm.
I have to be firm?
Yeah, or it won't be impressive. Okay. Let them hit it that hard. But you can hear it. It's beautiful, isn't it? We should have practiced. Okay, my point is, though, as you can see, because I don't have chapter 13. Diane has that next week. But, of course, we're all over the place, right? This is one letter. Brigham Young is saying, they hear the chimes, they hear the tinkling brass, or the sounding brass, or the tinkling cymbal, but there's no music. Isn't that a lovely analogy? It's just noise. I thought that was quite beautiful. So it's separating ourselves from God that causes the problems, right? But Paul says in 2:16, at the end of the verse, he's still in this natural man, spiritual man. For who hath known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. That is how you know things. Let's see. I'm so rattled by that bong. Okay, the natural man, with its ruts of negativity, such as Paul's talking about, divisions and strife and envy and jealousy, fear and pride. Don't you love those three words? Jealousy, fear, and pride. Those are the downfall of mankind, producing misery and victimization, We don't have to go there because we have the mind of God, which is truth and grace. But, you know, it takes being conscious of what is happening. If you're not conscious of it, your life gets away from you in all directions. So what is the mind of Christ? Let me ask you that. I know these are kind of deep questions, but it's more to get you not just letting them poof over your head, you know? What is the mind of Christ? Because Alma talks about it, Peter talks about it, Paul talks about it, Joseph Smith, and Jesus. So it must be out there, a concept. This mind that dwells in us, if we let it. Isn't that kind of weird that it dwells in us? So here's a couple of things. In the 16th century, the great Kabbalistic rabbi Isaac Luria offered a profoundly beautiful cosmology of the world. He said, in the beginning, there is Ein Sof, pure being, the absolute source of the world. The world begins with an emanation of light from the source, and then there's a great accident of cosmic proportions. The vessel holding the Or Ein Sof shattered and broke open, and the light of God was scattered throughout the universe into an infinite number of holy sparks. These countless sparks of holiness are hidden deep in everyone and everything, and the whole purpose of human life is to uncover these sparks of light and restore the world to its original wholeness. Everyone and everything we encounter is a shell or a container for a hidden spark of holiness. And it is our job to help free the hidden holiness in everything and everyone. Isn't that the most exquisite image, that everything has shards of holiness in them that were broken apart? Well, when Jesus died, what happened throughout the world? There were earthquakes, and everything was broken into pieces. And what happens every Sunday all over the world as pieces of Christ's body are broken and shattered and scattered and eaten? So you see, these are all symbolic ways of showing that the reality of the mind of Christ, which is the Father's mind, can be brought into us through the Holy Ghost, who Joseph Smith said, I don't need any books. I have the oldest book in the world, the Holy Ghost. My husband gave a lesson a few weeks ago and talked about glory. So without, you know, talking about what he said, let me just ask you, what is glory? Because where you find glory, you will find the mind of Christ. And that word glory is one of Paul's favorites. I only have time for one example, but we were just in Mexico on the Yucatan Peninsula with a friend, and we took her down. She was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease about a year ago, and it's progressing. So she can still walk, so once in a while we take her on a trip. And we've been on trips together, we skied together, she's exactly my age, she's beautiful. And anyway, so we're out in the ocean. We got her out in the ocean with a life vest, and we're dragging her around in the late afternoon sun. She's on her back, and she can't really move her legs well anymore. And we're laughing, and the waves are washing over us. That is glory. Or when our daughter, Lissa, was 10 months old, she was running around. We were living in Hawaii at the time, and I was making curry sauce, and it was bubbling, and she was in a little walker, and she only had on a diaper and rubber pants because it was hot. And she reached up and pulled the electric cord on the electric frying pan with the bubbling curry sauce. And it went over her entire body and burned her. And so I'm holding her in my hands. We're in the car, and my hands are burning. And her whole body is bubbling up like this from the burns. And I'm singing to her, and I won't tell you the whole thing, but we're in the hospital, and they have taken her away and are helping her, and we're there, and nobody knew. I mean, how could they have known so quickly? And this friend our age, we could see him at the end of the hall. He was walking down the hall, you know, toward us, just to be there with us. He didn't say a word. He just sat down by us. That is glory. That is, I know this is making a poetic jump, but that is the mind of Christ in you. So here's Brigham Young again. Listen to this amazing quote. It is the deity within us that causes increase. Yes, he is in every person upon the face of the earth. The elements that every individual is made of and lives in possess the Godhead. This you cannot understand, but you will hereafter. The deity within us is the great principle that causes us to increase and to grow in grace and truth. So, of course, they didn't understand it either, what Paul was trying to teach them. Look at 3 verses 1 through 4, and I'll kind of move quickly. But he talks about giving them milk instead of meat because they didn't get it, right? They were infants in spiritual understanding. He's just talked to them about how they're not understanding with their spiritual minds. Remember in Mosiah where the rising generation could not understand the words of Benjamin? Because they had not been there when he spoke them. It's the same thing. 3 over the page, 21 and 23 through 23. This is called Paul's Rhapsody. It's what the Christian world calls it, and it is quite beautiful. He says, therefore, let no man glory in men, for all things are yours. The world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours, he tells them. Isn't that word death in there interesting? In the last conference, I know this is weird, but the one thing that stood out the most for me was when Elder Nelson said, in fact, I wrote it down, and he's, you know, talked about this before, but the eventual death of your mortal body is a essential to God's great plan of happiness. Why? Because death will allow your spirit to return home to him. And I thought, yeah, I should stop worrying about getting old, you know. In Psalms 116:15, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. I think that's quite lovely for all of us. Moving along. Well, you're all moving along. All of you are. I hate to tell you. Okay. So chapter 7, you know, there are some topics which Paul gets on that are very annoying. So I'm not going to go into them, but I want to just point out one thing, that in this chapter about marriage and women and all of it, 4 times he says, this is my opinion, in different ways. But I did want to share my favorite one, which is 7 and 28. And this is from the New English Bible, which I've, you know, talked about before. If, however, you do marry, because they're asking him, should we get married? And he says, well, I say no, but, you know, that's my opinion. He says, if, however, you do marry, he was probably married, you know. He could not be a member of the Sanhedrin without being married. So most people think his wife had died and he was a widower. So, sorry, back again. If, however, you do marry, there's nothing wrong in it. But those who marry will have pain and grief in this bodily life, and my aim is to spare you. Awesome. Okay, so starting in chapter 8, we're just going to skip chapter 7 anyway, we don't have time. So one of the questions asked him is about if they could eat meat. Was it permissible to eat meat that had been sacrificed to pagan idols? Because that was a big issue in the Hellenistic and Roman cities. Because a lot of the meat that was in the markets, or the shambles is what they called it, had been part of these sacrifices. And the priests then went and sold it to the butchers, and the people ate it. That's how they got their meat. So it was a problem. Could, you know, can we eat this meat? They're asking Paul. So now he's beginning to answer their questions. And he says, verse 8 of 8, if the meat commendeth, he said, but meat commendeth us not to God. For neither if we eat are we better, neither if we don't eat are we better. He said, it doesn't matter. But here's what matters. And then he says, if it becomes a stumbling block, I'd read the whole thing, but we're almost out of time. He says, verse 9, take heed lest by any means what you're doing is a stumbling block to someone else. If they think it's wrong to eat meat and they see you eat meat, then you will be the cause of them going against their conscience, you see? So when my seminary teacher, when I was a senior in high school, said, you have to take seminary because everybody's watching what you do. And I said, I can't, I have to be in madrigals and I have to be in a cappella. And they were so mad at me. But they had a point. You know, if I didn't take it, I was a stumbling block. And thus, I would sin against Christ, verse 12. So that's his first point. You could do a whole lesson on that. The next point, though, was this really interesting theme, and that's what I want to end on. He goes back to his theme of knowing. So go to 8, 1 and 2. Now, as touching things offered unto idols, see, they've asked him, he's answering. And I'm going to read it in the New English. Of course we all have knowledge, as you say. So this is 8 and 1. This knowledge breeds conceit. It is love that builds. The King James says edifieth. It is love that builds. If anyone fancies that he knows nothing yet, in the true sense of knowing. And then verse 3, but if any man love God, the same is known of him. So Paul is more worried about their arrogance here, because you know, if you have any, and we know, if we have any intelligence, the more you learn, the more you know, how less you know, right? So they don't seem to have, you know, caught on to that. There is the painter Tintoretto in the Renaissance. This is why I brought my mother's painting of the sea. So Tintoretto threw down his brushes in despair and declared, the sea grows always greater. Nobody can paint it. Isn't that lovely? The sea grows always greater. Nobody can paint it. So Paul brings love into this letter now, In fact, it's in almost every one of his chapters building toward the great chapter 13 on charity. But what is the connection here between love and knowing? Now, there is an interesting question. So I don't have time to really ask you, but here's a couple things. When my daughter, Kara, was in ballet, she danced a long time, years, was on point. And one day, her ballet mistress, Mickey Casolino from Brooklyn, she came over to me when I was picking Kara up, and she said to me, "Some kids respond better when I get mad at them, but Kara responds better to encouragement." And I remember looking at her thinking, "Woman, you are crazy. You're mad. You're nuts. What child responds better to anger? What child can learn when they are not being loved? When they don't feel safe?" So it is love at work when there is increase. He says, "If I love," verse 3, "if a man love God," if I love, actually in other translations it leaves off the God, which is interesting. "If I love, God knows me." So when Paul says, verse chapter 13 and 12, "Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known." So then all things will be out in the open, right? Do you know what the etymology of to know is? This is crucial. It is to touch. If I love, God touches me. He knows me. He touches me. If you go back to 2 and 9 of this book, "But it, as it is written, eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither hath entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him." He wants to touch us. He's the only one who knows everything about us, and he's pleading to touch us, to know us. In Galatians it says, "After you are known of God, how can you leave him? After he has touched you, how can you leave him?" That is the question of this life, isn't it? So let me just end. He talks about some other things, you know. I mean, there's so many things. Sexual immorality. He explains why it is bad. Do you want an answer of why it's bad? It's right here. It's because when you do that, you damage yourself. You are the temple of God. You're the Holy Ghost is in you, and you're damaging it. He talks about temptation, and then he ends with, just go quickly to 10 and 24. He says, "Let no man seek his own, but every man another's wealth." And then 26, "For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." And 33, "Even as I please all men in all things, not seeking mine own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved." And then back in 4:7, he says, and this is the New English, "What do you possess that was not given you? If then you really received it all as a gift, why take credit to yourself?" And then look at Paul's Rhapsody again, 3:21-23. Because he's saying, be generous, because all things are yours. All things are yours. why are you being so, you know, selfish? All things are yours, the world or life or death or things present or things to come. All are yours, and ye are Christ's, and Christ is God's. In the name of Jesus.